Good morning to each one this morning. I trust that we have already been blessed as we have sung songs together and studied the Word of God together and heard the Word read to us. Before I go into the message, and since I have the... if I can find what I'm looking for. Since I have the podium here, I'm going to just share a couple things that I wanted to share sometime. Here several weeks ago, I was wanting to do a little checking, a little research on the standards of the Pacific Coast Conference back in 1924. Wanted to check into that in relation to what we're doing, and I thought, and I found it to be true that a lot of the verbiage in our standard is taken from that. That's kind of beside the point here. But where I went was to the Pacific Northwest Historical Society building right next to the Zion Church up at Hubbard. And I had never been to their new facility before. I had been when they had a place at the Western Mennonite School, had been there. But Margaret Shetler, who does a lot of the filing and keeping track of things, she told me, she said, tell your people that we have this facility here. It's open. It's for all Mennonites. If there's something you want to check out, come check it out. And so while I was there, there was something I was kind of interested in. I looked or said something. Yeah, they found it right away. She also said, if your congregation has any documents, any old documents or anything that you want preserved, we have a place for that here. We would be glad to do that. So I thought I'd just pass that on since she had specifically told me to do that. The other thing I wanted to share sometime, a little hesitant in a way, didn't know exactly how to go about this. I put on the bulletin boards a email that Paul and I got from one of our workers, Brian Jasko. A lot of you know him. And this was, I think, before Christmas, and he just wanted to thank us for the privilege of working for us. And he said specifically in there to tell our congregation, to tell our families, the blessing that you have been in his life and in the life of others. And he said it's not just the people that come to your church that are blessed by your people. And so I thought I'd put it on the board. You can look at that. And I'm not giving that as a matter of pride or anything, but just because he did say, I said, well, should I tell the church this? Yeah, he said, do that. All right. I guess I should have been a little bit more alert to where we were for a Sunday school lesson. But, you know, we didn't have church last Sunday, and... So I guess whatever the excuses are, but actually, I guess I'm going to try to maybe expand somewhat on the subject that we had out of 2 Corinthians 8 this morning in the adult Sunday school lesson. I've chosen this morning to speak on the subject of Christian mutual aid. And I would like to use as a text Galatians 6:10. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. Now, mutual aid has been a hallmark of the Church of Jesus Christ from the time of its foundation, the time of the apostles, to today. When one is born again by the Spirit of God, not only are we concerned for our own spiritual welfare and the spiritual welfare of our fellow men, but there is something I believe within the believer's heart that burns within us, desiring to give practical assistance to those of like faith. Now, the definition of the word mutual is a couple definitions. Having the same feelings one for the other. In other words, I can maybe have feeling toward you, but you don't toward me, so that's not mutual. Another definition is shared in common. And as Paul told the Corinthian church in the lesson that we studied today in verse 14, But by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. And so, Christian mutual aid is a two-way street. I'd like to look at this, I guess, in probably about seven major portions here. Seven minor portions. You know, we have short devotions, so we have to have short points. So I'm going to try to get through this. But the first is that I'd like to look at is God's providence. You know, it was really interesting for me to think of this in relation to us helping one another, that there are certain characteristics and attributes of our Heavenly Father that show that He is interested in caring for those in need. And His willingness, His desire to help those in need, lays a groundwork for us. That we can have a caring heart for His people. There's several different groups of people or actually animals too that God seems to have a special heart for. Jeremiah 49 verse 11 says, "Leave thy fatherless children, I will preserve them alive, and let thy widows trust in me." And so we find again and again that God cares for the widows and He cares for the fatherless. I'd like to turn to Deuteronomy 10 and read several verses there, verses 17 to 19. Deuteronomy 10. "For the Lord your God is God of gods, and Lord of lords, a great God, and mighty and terrible, which regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." And so here, God is also interested in the stranger. Not necessarily someone of our own. He says, "You were strangers in the land of Egypt." Remember that. Psalm 68 verse 5 says, "A father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in His holy habitation." I think of how God preserved Israel in the 40 years in the wilderness. And that's an outstanding example of His care of His people. He gave them food. He preserved their raiment. Now, I don't know, you sisters, how would you like to wear the same dress for 40 years? You wouldn't even have to go to the fabric store, would you? Probably wouldn't like that too good. But, you know, their clothes did not wax old, and He protected them. Now, I found this of interest, and maybe I'm going to just throw it out. There are two examples in the animal kingdom that are portrayed, particularly in the Old Testament, of having a ferocious appetite, and that God meets that need. Can anyone tell me what those two are? Young lion. All right. What's the other one? It's a bird. The raven. I never quite put that together. Have you ever heard of someone that had a ravenous appetite? Raven, yes. Okay. So let me just read a little bit here. First of all, in Job. Job 38, verses 39 to 41. Job 38, 39. "Wilt thou hunt the prey for the lion, or fill the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie in wait? Who provideth for the raven his food? When his young ones cry unto God, they wander for lack of meat." So who takes care of the needs of this, of these young lions and these ravens? Psalm 34:10 says, "The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing." Psalm 147 verse 9 says, "He giveth to the beast his food, and to the young ravens which cry." Then Jesus also talked about the ravens in Luke 12, 12:24 says, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which neither have storehouse nor barn, and God feedeth them. How much more are ye better than the fowls? And then in Matthew 6:26, God feeds the fowls of the air. I don't think I'll turn there. We also know where Jesus said that if a sparrow falls, that God takes note of that. And so if our God is so concerned about his creation, if he is so concerned about the ravens and the young lions and about the widows and the fatherless and the stranger, should not his children, which try to pattern their life after him, care for the unfortunate about us? I think of the ministry of Jesus, how it was filled with the goodness of God. He went about doing good. He healed the sick. He gave food to the hungry. He ministered to the lonely. And that's just a brief snapshot of the good things that Jesus did. And our devotional this morning, Brother John, had some of those things. Very, very good, the things that we should do. All right, now I'd like to go to the second point, and that is what some of the Old Testament practices were. And I didn't do a major study of this. But the law made provision for the widows and for the poor. And they were allowed to glean in the fields and the vineyards and on the olive trees. Now, we know the story of Ruth. She was a widow, and we know how that she went out and gleaned there in the fields of Boaz. But this was allowed in the law. And I, in the Mosaic law, part of the tithe that people gave was to go to the poor and to the widows. Every seventh year, the land was to be left untilled and just let it grow up of itself. And what came was to be for the widows and the poor. Deuteronomy 15, verse 11 says, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor and to thy needy in thy land. So he says, don't be stingy. This was part of the law. Don't be stingy. Open thy hand wide to the brother, to the poor, to the needy that are in your land. I guess something I had not really checked into previous to preparing this message was what took place between the Testaments, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We know that that time frame was following the exile or the captivity. We also know in reading in Nehemiah, probably particularly, there were a lot of poor people. They came back from Babylon, and it seemed like they just had a hard time getting established, and there were many poor. And so there got to be more of an emphasis placed on almsgiving because poverty was widespread. And so it got to be considered pious to give to the poor. And actually, during this time, begging became a profession. There were those who took up the profession of begging. We find that carried on through into the New Testament. Gradually, the giving of alms with the motive of compassion and of gratitude to God, that was changed to it being regarded as an act that gained merit with God and actually had sacrificial and atoning values. And this is taught or was taught in a couple of the books of the Apocrypha, that if you give alms to the poor, it is salvation to your soul. In Ecclesiasticus, I guess that's right, 3:30, it says, almsgiving atones for sin. And Tobit 12:9 says, almsgiving delivers from death and it will purge away every sin. And so the giving of alms and righteousness were synonymous in those people's minds. Now, what's interesting to me is that this was the prevailing view in the day of Jesus. And so when we find him talking about giving of alms, it's kind of with that background. And so we need to realize that need to view it in the light of the teaching of the Pharisees. He did not condemn aiding the poor, but he did rebuke those who did it for a show. In fact, he said, "Don't sound the trumpet before you." Now, I don't know if that was literal or whether he was just saying, "Don't blow your own horn," like we might say. Just look what I've done. Look at all that I've given to the needs of those about us. So now let's look a little bit closer at the teachings of Jesus. Jesus commanded liberal giving. In Luke 6:38, he says, "Give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down and shaken together, and running over shall men give into your bosom, for with the same measure that ye meet withal shall it be measured to you again." And then he said in Luke 12:33, let's see, is that the one John read? I'm not quite sure. He said, "Sell that ye have and give alms." And his teaching, I believe, was not so much to merit salvation as it was to try to help his followers to negate the stranglehold that materialism would get upon us. Jesus did say, and Paul quotes that in Acts 2:35, he said it's more blessed to give than receive. Now, unfortunately, sometimes when we get to talking about mutual aid, Christian mutual aid, it almost seems like it's more blessed to receive than to give. But that's not what Jesus said. So when we think of this subject, it should be in the context of giving, but it also needs to be in the context of receiving if it's going to be mutual. I'm going to read Mark 12 and Mark 12:41-44, and we see a little bit what Jesus' attitude was toward giving. It wasn't so much the amount that was given, but it is the matter of self-denial. And we have here the story, well-known story of the widow and her mite. Two mites, I guess. Mark 12:41. "And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples and said unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury, for they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living." It almost seems here that those who put in lots of money came with a lot of pomp, with a lot of noise, so that people knew what was happening. This widow, she also wanted to give to the work of the Lord. She just slipped in there and put in her two mites and went on again. But Jesus took note of that. All right, we have a lot of teaching then, and practical outworking in the early church. We find a lot in the book of Acts, and also it's mentioned quite often in the epistles. So if you want to turn to the book of Acts, I'm going to just read several passages here. First of all, Acts 2, the latter part of the chapter, verses 42-47. "And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers, and fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles, and all that believed were together and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved." It would appear that as they shared one with another, that they run out of cash. They run out of available funds. And so many of them sold their possessions, and it says that they parted to all men as every man had need. Not necessarily what somebody wanted, but what the need might be. Going over to the fourth chapter, we have basically the same thing. Chapter 4, verses 32 to 37. And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them, and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man, notice again, according as he had need. And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. And then we know, I'm not going to go into the account in the next chapter of Ananias and Sapphira, but we know how they also sold their land, their property, and brought money. But they were not honest in what they brought, pretended that they brought everything, and they had not. So then we go on, and this looks pretty good. You know, everyone's needs were being taken care of, regardless of who they were. But all of a sudden there was, I don't know if you'd call it racial discrimination or social discrimination or whatever it was. But we go to chapter 6 and there was some complaints. It said, you know, you Jews are being taken care of and we Greeks, the widows of the Greeks are not. Chapter 6, verse 1. In those days when the number of the disciples was multiplied, there rose a murmuring of the Grecians against the Hebrews because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration. And then we know that it was because of that that the deacons were ordained. All right, let's go to chapter 11. And Scott, I don't know, maybe you want to study into this for next Sunday. But I'm wondering if this is the basis on which chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians comes back to. But let's read this once. Acts 11, verse 27. And in those days came prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch. And there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be great dearth throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. And so it was prophesied there was going to be a dearth, there was a famine in Jerusalem. Those in other areas wanted to help them. And I think this is all connected. I may not have it right, but if we go to 1 Corinthians 16, Paul was encouraging the Corinthians to start accumulating some funds that they might be able to send to Jerusalem to help out there. 1 Corinthians 16, first three verses. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. And when I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. And so he said, get the money together, and when I come, we'll figure out who's going to take it to Jerusalem. Now, if we go over to our Sunday school lesson today, 2 Corinthians 8, first five verses says, Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints, And this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord, and then to us by the will of God. And then in this, it seems as if Titus was involved in taking these funds, and so that may not quite tie in with Acts 11. I didn't really study that out thoroughly. Now, I think I'm going to turn to 1 Timothy 5. I'd like to read this chapter. I know, well, not all of it, but most of it. And this is, I think, probably about the best exposition in the New Testament that we get of how to care for the widows. And it says that the family should be, it should be required of the family, but the church should pick up where the family can't in taking care of widows. I'm going to read the first 16 verses. Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren, the elder women as mothers, the younger as sisters, with all purity. Honor widows that are widows indeed. But if any widow have children or nephews, and I think that nephews would have the thought of grandchildren, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplication and prayers night and day. And I'm reminded of Anna, who was in the temple there, and she did that. And she was shown the Messiah baby. Verse 6, but she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. And these things give in charge that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man, well reported of for good works. If she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. But the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry, having damnation because they have cast off their first faith. And withal they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will, therefore, that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some are already turned aside after Satan. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. And so we have woven together a fabric that says that family is first of all responsible to take care of the needs of their own, particularly of widows. The church is responsible to make sure that they are taken care of. This of not receiving them into the before they're 60 years of age. I think there was kind of an order of women that were maybe, I don't know what you'd, not necessarily deaconesses, but they would go about taking care of needs of people, and there was maybe an order of widows that did that. It seemed to me that that's somewhat what it's speaking of here. All right, we need to move on. James 1:27 says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. All right, so that was the apostolic church. Now, did it stop there? Should it stop there? We find then that it did continue on through the centuries, and we find a little bit. I didn't have a chance to do a lot of research, but in the years following the apostles in the next 200-300 years, I have a couple quotes that I thought were interesting. Cyprian in 2050 said, let the poor be taken care of as much and as well as possible. I speak especially of those who have stood with unmovable faith and have not forsaken Christ's flock. So that goes back to our text verse that says to do good as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good to all men, especially unto those who are the household of faith. And so he said, let the poor be taken care of, and especially those who have stood with unmovable faith. He also said, see how much he sins in the church, he who prefers himself and his children to Christ. Such a person preserves his wealth and does not share his abundant estate to relieve the poverty of the needy. So here he's saying it's wrong if you have adequate and you just keep it all for yourself and don't share with those who are in need. Now, the apostolic constitutions, and this was compiled in about 390. I have a couple quotes there. If some persons are neither widows nor widowers, but stand in need of assistance, either because of poverty, disease, or the responsibility of a great number of children, it is your duty to oversee all people and to take care of them all. It also says, if anyone is in need because of gluttony, drunkenness, or idleness, he does not deserve any assistance. So they got just a little bit hard-hearted with some people. All right. A lot of other interesting quotes. There was one that in addressing martyrs. And what would martyrs, how would martyrs look at, you know, leaving their wife and their, particularly their children. And it says there to leave the beloved ones to the care of God, and they will never lack protection. There's another quote, and I didn't write it down, that encourages help to unknown people because the motive behind it is kindness. All right, let's jump ahead several centuries to the Anabaptists. I'm going to quote from Mennonites in Europe by John Horsch. There's a little section on that. It says this: among the Swiss brethren, one of the questions addressed to applicants for baptism was whether they consecrated themselves with all their temporal possessions to the service of God and his people. In 1557, now that would have been about 30 years after the Swiss brethren started, a member of the established Protestant Church of Strasbourg in Alsace visited a meeting of the Swiss brethren near that city. A number of persons were received into the church by baptism on that occasion. Among the questions addressed to the applicants before the ordinance was administered was this: whether they, if necessity required it, would devote all their possessions to the service of the brotherhood and would not fail any member that is in need if they were able to render aid. And I'm not sure how that all worked out in practicality there among the Swiss brethren. The one thing we have quite a bit of record, and that is that the Dutch brethren in Holland, they were not persecuted as long or quite as severely as the Swiss were, and they actually became quite wealthy businessmen, the Mennonites did. And they heard of the persecution and the terrible things that their brethren in Switzerland were facing. And see, I've got a little something here I'd like to read if I can find it. Severe persecution in Zurich and Bern in 1671 brought the waves of immigrants, an estimated 700 persons from Bern, and the waves of immigrants were to the Platinant. Among them were cripples, old persons up to 90 years of age, and families with as many as 12 children. Most came without money or possessions and carried all they owned on their backs and their small children in their arms. Letters sent to Holland Mennonites vividly described the extremely poor condition of these Swiss Anabaptists. Their brethren from Holland immediately sent aid and visited them. And what I found so interesting about this is that we know about the martyr's mirror. And the man that put that together, what's his name? Thielman Jans von Braat. He personally visited those poor Swiss brethren. And they decided to give them aid. And they sent, the Dutch Mennonites formed a committee for foreign needs. And they contributed about 11,000 guilders, which is $150,000 worth. That's a lot of money in those years. They also gave very heavily to those who wanted to immigrate to America. They would pay for their passage. Why did they give? Was it because it was my fleshly brother? Was it because some friend I had, because it was a neighbor? No, the reason they gave was because they were brothers and sisters of similar faith and practice. Okay, now, mutual aid then was continued by Mennonites on down past the time of the Anabaptists as we know them. And so it did not, the concept of mutual aid did not die with the Anabaptists. I'd like to read this from an article, Mutual Aid, History and Principles. This was in a newsletter of the Anabaptist Financial. When the catastrophe of the Bolshevik Revolution, that'd be in Russia, and communism overwhelmed the Mennonite colonies in Russia, American and Canadian Mennonites organized the Mennonite Central Committee in 1920 to coordinate aid for the persecuted Russian Mennonites. Again, this aid was not offered as a result of family connections or formal church affiliations, but out of sympathy for the plight of fellow Anabaptists. Relief supplies were collected and shipped. Orphans were fed and refugees were helped on their way to new homes. Tens of thousands of Mennonites escaped Russia, many able to do so because of the brotherhood assistance offered by Anabaptist believers in the United States and Canada. In my library, I was just wondering how much is there about Christian aid or mutual aid? And I found that almost any of the Mennonite history books, if you go to the index, has mutual aid. Mennonites in Europe, Glimpses of Mennonite History and Doctrine, Mennonite Church in America, Apart and Together about the Mennonites in Oregon, the Mennonites in Illinois, and our own history book of Tangent. Now, in more recent times, and I see I'm running out of time, not sure how much to give here, but in more recent times, insurance has been used rather than mutual aid in many situations. In Separate Unto God, J.C. Wenger clearly points out in his chapter on stewardship and Christian aid that we're living in a different time than our forefathers a century and a half ago. And rural agricultural living, as it was known, has been replaced by large corporations, and a large outlay of capital is needed to farm. And how do we as Mennonite people navigate such a society? So many have turned to insurance in an effort to protect their assets. So does this override brotherhood? Again, I'd like to read a little bit from this same article from Anabaptist Financial. It says, today the common availability of commercial insurance can mitigate the practice of brotherhood mutual aid among us. Do your attitudes and actions reflect an insurance mentality or a mutual aid mentality? Now, I want you to ask yourself that question. I am going to say personally, as I have looked at this, I'm afraid I have swung a little bit more toward the insurance mentality and away from the mutual aid than what I was as a younger man. I think I need to take a look at that. Okay, listen to this. Commercial insurance is a contractual agreement with a secular financial company. It seeks to provide a guarantee against loss. Your financial status is to be reimbursed and restored. The benefits you may receive are based solely on how much you are willing and able to pay. Essentially, commercial insurance is a risk management strategy exercised on an individual basis. By contrast, mutual aid is a loyalty arrangement within a brotherhood. Although the brethren may not be able to restore all the conditions that existed before loss occurred, they care about your needs and seek to assist in love. Rather than being based on what you can pay, mutual aid is rendered on the basis of who you are. If you are a member of the body of Christ, the other members care about your loss and seek to restore you. If you value a system that works through secular financial markets, A. B. tries to guarantee against all losses, C. is based only on what you can afford to pay, then you're probably more interested in commercial insurance than Brotherhood Mutual Aid. If you value a system that A, is a loyal arrangement between people of similar faith and values, B, promises assistance knowing it may not be able to restore all possible financial losses, and C, covers all within a faith community regardless of their ability to pay, then you probably have more of a mutual aid mentality. Mutual aid or insurance mentality, what kind of attitude do you have today? What is the prevailing attitude in your local church? In general, is the biblical pattern of brotherhood, mutual aid growing stronger or weaker in conservative Anabaptist churches? I'm going to take the time just to give you a couple examples of in the earlier years of the Tangent Church of some mutual aid that was given. Probably a lot of you here, many of you would, but maybe a lot of you don't remember Merle Stutzman. Merle Stutzman was a minister in our congregation for a number of years. And he had a banker. Now, there was a bank. I'm really getting back in time here. There was a bank at Shedd. And his banker at Shedd was after him. He said, "You need to insure your property." And Merle says, "No," he says, I put my trust in the Lord rather than in financial institutions." Well, time went on, and Merle had a fire in his house, pretty substantial fire. It didn't burn the house clear down, but it was pretty bad there. And so there was an outpouring of love from the congregation, but also from others, from other places. And he actually, I don't know if I'm right on this or not, that he would have got enough, but he built a new house. I think enough to get started on that anyhow. He went back to his banker and he said, "Here is my insurance. Mutual aid." I'd like to give a little bit of a personal story. Maybe I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to anyhow. I was trying to figure it out. I think it's probably been 39 years ago. I had a preaching assignment at Catawba, Idaho. And we went, my first wife Marilyn and I and our three oldest children. And we went to there, and it was a very snowy, icy weekend. In fact, we stayed overnight in Spokane so that I could cross the pass in the daylight. And so as we were going out of Coeur d'Alene, right along the lake there, I hit a patch of black ice. And not being used to driving on ice, I did the wrong thing and went clear across four lanes of traffic. And there was a pickup coming around the corner that hit us broadside, knocked me out. Marilyn got bruised up pretty bad. The children, I guess they bounced around. They seemed to be all right. But anyhow, I did not have collision insurance. I had liability, but I didn't have collision. I didn't really feel that was what I should have. So the church helped us out, and I was very grateful for that. And we were short some, but that was okay. And we'd be able to make that work. Several weeks later, there was an envelope came in the mail without a return address. And I opened it. And out came a paper that said, "God told me to send this to you." I was flabbergasted. There was five $100 bills. Now, maybe that doesn't sound like a lot, but in today's money, that's about $2,000. Now, I got to thinking about that. Had I had full coverage, the insurance adjuster, would God have told the insurance adjuster to pay my deductible? And had God told him that, would have he listened? I told different people I was so thankful to deal with a deacon rather than an insurance adjuster. Well, I'm out of time. got a little bit more to say, but I guess we'll just let it go with that. I will close with this. Are we, as God's children, portraying the love and care that He has for all of His creatures? If God cares for the sparrow and the raven and the young lion, the widow and the fatherless and the stranger, should not His children care for their fellow believers in time of need? I think the answer is very obvious. All right, let's have a closing number to follow.